I didn't, but I sat on the swing set considering suggestions for a very long time, and I have never been afraid of the dark since. Drives to Nowhere, Automotive Journalism. The great advantage to humor as a trade is that ignorance has a positive value. I don't understand the balanced budget amendment. Isn't it like trying to stop smoking by hiding cigarettes from yourself? I don't understand term limits. Do we want a dog who knows where all the bones are buried, or do we want a dog who'll dig up the whole yard? I don't understand abortion arguments. Why is it bad to kill a little baby, but okay to kill a teensy-weensy one? And I don't understand why the same newspaper commentators who bemoan the terrible education given to poor people are always so eager to have those poor people get out and vote. Most of my professional life has been spent expressing my ignorance of politics and current events, but there are other subjects I don't know about, cars being chief among them. My grandfather and my Uncle Arch owned a Buick dealership. My father was a sales manager. Uncle Joe ran the used car lot. All the O'Rourkes worked there, myself included. My first vivid memory is of a car, a 1949 electric blue Buick Century convertible with red leather upholstery. I love cars. But I love cars the way I love women. I don't know how to fix them, I wouldn't presume to design one, and, when they are beautiful and fast, they make me stupid enough to say such things as, "I love cars the way I love women." My career as an automotive journalist I owe to David E. Davis, Jr. When he took over the editorship of Car and Driver in 1977, Davis realized that many of the magazine's readers, while enthusiastic about motor vehicles, were almost as unknowledgeable as I. He wanted an editorial link to the dumbbells. I wrote for Car and Driver until 1985, when Davis left to found Automobile Magazine, and I followed. During these 18 years, I have driven the best cars, traveled through the most beautiful scenery, stayed at the tip-top hotels, and tasted the highest cuisine and finest libations of a dozen countries, all on an expense account. This goes to prove something I've long believed, that journalism can make the world a better place for me. The Welsh National Combined Mud Wrestling and Spelling Bee Championship. Mucking about in the Forest Foar, Clandwy Brefi, Pontryd Fendigid, and other orthographically difficult places. Car and Driver, 1984. Author's note. In late 1983, a party of 16 Car and Driver staff members, friends, and dependents drove 9 off-road vehicles across the pavement-free middle of Wales. Ostensibly, our mission was to test a cross-section of American four-wheel drive products against their British, German, and Japanese counterparts. In fact, what we were doing was illustrating the central idea of all automotive journalism: getting money to do what one would spend money to do if one hadn't found a way to be paid for doing it. A Ford Bronco 2, a Chevrolet S10 Blazer, a GMC S15 Jimmy, a Jeep Cherokee, a Land Rover, 2 Range Rovers, a Mercedes-Benz Geländewagen, and a Mitsubishi Montero were used on the trip. Since these are now a dozen model years old, I have excised the technical chatter about them. Wales, on the other hand, has not had a major redesign since Owen Glendower got whooped at Harlech Castle in 1409. You might think off-road driving in the British Isles would be a matter of, "Very good, sir. We'll have Mrs. Twickham take down her front trellis, and you can motor about in her rose garden, then turn sharp at the rookery and go right through the private hedge and into the vicar's kitchen yard." But it's not like that at all. Even though Britain has a population density about double that of Macy's toy floor at Christmas time, there are still vast tracts of empty moor, fen, bog, wold, and other kinds of wilderness that the Brits have funny names for. The really tough part, however, is getting out of London. The Limeys just can't shake their national dyslexia about which side of the road is for tailgating and which is for head-on collisions. And I can't remember to list to port. But I have, I think, finally come up with the proper mnemonic device. What you have to do is think of yourself as a well-dressed socialist. Keep left, look right, keep left, look right. See? This makes driving in England a snap, as long as you don't have to pass, change lanes, go through roundabouts, or shift gears. The English also have a road numbering system based on the Duke of Wellington's cribbage scores. Thus, it was in a dither of confusion, occasional naked fear, and also rain and jet lag that we made our way 50 miles west up the Thames to the village of Streatley. There, with hoots of relief from the Yanks, we got off the paved road and into some nice safe precipices, cliffs, and escarpments. A remarkable geological feature called the Ridgeway begins at Streatley. The Ridgeway is a narrow fold of chalk highlands that stretches west for 40 miles along the crest of the Berkshire Downs and into northern Wiltshire. The country falls away in perfect symmetry on either side, and the view of England is too wonderful to be fact. If you were the kind of child who created imaginary worlds on your bedspread, this is what you saw from your knees. The Ridgeway has been in use as a thoroughfare since 3000 BC, and it is still in better shape than most streets in New York. Even so, wet grass, slippery chalk soil, and gale-force winds blowing up off the Salisbury Plain made the going tricky. I had no more sighed with relief to be out of traffic when I became what's known as cross-rutted, meaning I got the front wheels into a set of ruts that were headed toward Lisbon, and the back wheels into a set pointed at Reykjavik. As a result, I spun. I barely dropped anchor in time to avoid committing an act of civil disobedience, protesting the General Enclosure Act of 1801. That is, I nearly hit a fence. At midday, we stopped at Wantage, birthplace of Alfred the Great, A.D. 849, which, like most English villages, is possessed of a millennium's accumulated cuteness. We needed lunch, and we also needed enough petrol for our Africa Corps-sized expedition. If you're planning an off-road jaunt in England, or anywhere else, you might try it with fewer people and vehicles. We went through the Midlands and Wales at about the same rate of speed as Geoff Chaucer's Canterbury package tour. It was fun, though, carrying our own house party with us, and the Wantage pubs appreciated the 2,000% increase in custom. Back on the Ridgeway, we did some serious rooting about in the truffle pit of history. Here, between Wantage and Swindon, is the immense White Horse, a 365-foot-long, 130-foot-wide equine figure carved into the chalk hillside. Alfred the Great supposedly dug the thing himself as a memorial to the drubbing he gave the pagan Danes at nearby Ashdown. More likely it's twice as old as that and was the totemic emblem of some gang of Celtic biker types. Anyway, it gives its name to the fine valley below, the Vale of White Horse, and also the White Horse Tavern on Hudson Street in New York, where Dylan Thomas drank himself to death in 1953. A fine description of the area, the Vale area, not Hudson Street, was left by Thomas Hughes in Tom Brown's School Days. And the Scotch was left by us in the Land Rover. Whoops. It gets awfully cold and windy out in the middle of history. Actually, the White Horse is not best viewed from the Ridgeway Heights. From up there, it looks like something you might get yourself into on a golf course and need a chalk wedge to get out of again. There is a nice hill alongside, however, where St. George slew the dragon. Unanswered questions. Was it dragon season? Is it sporting to slay them when they aren't on the wing? Was St. George careful to extinguish all dragon breath fires and pick up the spent lance tips and empty mead cans in his dragon blind? No grass will grow on the place where the dragon's blood was spilled. This is because people walk around on it all the time, looking for the place where grass won't grow. Back closer to where the whiskey and the cars were is an ancient hill fort called Uffington Castle. Nothing is left of it now except the turf mounds where the ramparts stood. Eerie to think of my blue-painted ancestors squatting here among the watchfires and plotting the same kinds of things my cousins are plotting tonight in some Belfast pub. A bit farther along the Ridgeway is Wayland's Smithy, a new Stone Age long barrow of prodigious size. Presumably it was a burial chamber, but it may have been used for prehistoric games of nude stoop tag. There is, after all, much we don't know about the peoples of ancient Britain. A Saxon legend of later date makes the barrow home to Wayland Smith, a blacksmith. If your horse threw a shoe while you were riding along the Ridgeway, you were supposed to leave a silver coin on a stone, whistle 3 times, and turn your back. Wayland would then shoe your horse and take the money. However, this does not work with a pound note and a Land Rover. But who wants a horseshoe pounded into his Land Rover's tire anyway? By now we were full to the gills with history, and practically empty of scotch, so it was time to push on to the night's lodgings. These were in Cowbridge, 70 miles away across the Severn and down the Welsh coast past Cardiff. We'd planned to get on the M4 at Swindon and speed across the Severn Bridge in time to get really stupid and loud before dinner, but the high winds we'd been fighting all day caused the bridge to be closed. We had to make a massive detour up the Severn estuary, 40 miles to Gloucester, then 70 miles back down to Cowbridge. It was nearly 11 by the time we got there, so we had to settle for getting loud and stupid during dinner instead of before. The people at the Bear Hotel were lovely, though. That is, they didn't evict us at gunpoint. Caveat gobbler, however, about UK food, especially if you're tired and have had a few and are in the giggling sort of mood where you order what sounds funny on the menu. I ordered whitebait, which turned out to be a plateful of deep-fat fried guppies. The nearest McDonald's was 153 miles away in London. The sun, and the whitebait, came up the next day, and we pushed west to Port Talbot, where Richard Burton went to high school. Port Talbot bears a striking resemblance to Muncie, Indiana. We then avoided Swansea, where Dylan Thomas failed to drink himself to death because he didn't get home from New York in time, and motored inland along the River Neath to Aberdeley, where, according to local history, nothing much has ever happened. In Aberdeley, we left the pavement and turned onto the Sarn Helen, the principal Roman road linking North and South Wales. The name comes from Helen, wife of Magnus Maximus, who was Roman emperor for about 5 minutes in A.D. 383. Either that, or the name comes from Ycleng, Welsh for the legion, or from Ilin, which means angle, or from anything else you can think of. Although the Sarn Helen is much newer than the Ridgeway, it's in much worse shape. The Ridgeway has good natural drainage, and it remained in active use until the early 1800s, but maintenance on the Sarn Helen stopped in A.D. 410, when the emperor, Flavius Honorius, took time out from being chased around Italy by Alaric the Visigoth to write a letter to the Britons telling them to take care of their own damn roads. The Romans made a better road than anyone ever has since. For a primary road like the Sarn Helen, they dug parallel ditches more than 80 feet apart and excavated the soil between them. Then they laid in a sand and quarry stone foundation bound on either side by tightly fitted curbs of dressed and wedged stone blocks. On top of this foundation, they built an embankment 4 or 5 feet high and 50 feet wide, constructed of layers of ram chalk and flint, and finished with a screened gravel crown 2 feet thick. Even so, 1,573 years of neglect have taken their toll. The road is worn down, and topsoil has accumulated along it, and the Sarn Helen has turned from an embankment into a ditch. There are washouts and mud holes and boulders in the ditch, too. But the Sarn Helen is still there. I doubt we'll be able to say the same about I-95 in the year 3556. Our first problem, however, was the work of man and not nature. Some farmer had dropped a big oak across the right-of-way, one of those very tangly and many-branched oaks. Apparently, it was felled on purpose to keep such trendies as ourselves from lurking about and luring sheep and daughters to chic London night spots. Fortunately, among our horde of traveling companions was Roger Crathorne, demonstrations manager for Land Rover Limited. Roger is one of the most accomplished off-road drivers ever. Also, fortunately, Rovers have winches. Roger used the winch on his Range Rover and the winch on the Land Rover to create something that looked like what I flunked in high school trig. Then he deftly set the oak back among its roadside mates, while the rest of us stood around and gaped and drank bloody scotches. A bloody scotch is what you drink when you want a Bloody Mary but don't have any vodka. It's just like a regular Bloody Mary, but with scotch instead of vodka, and without tomato juice, Worcestershire sauce, celery sticks, or any of the rest of that stuff. You drink it right out of the bottle. Once past the tree blockade, we drove uphill through gullies so narrow that the bigger vehicles were digging mud with their door handles until we achieved the crest from which rustic beauty positively vomited forth. Mist upon the heather, scudding clouds above, tree trunks artfully gnarling, all the usual stuff. A ruined stone house commanded the hill. There were arrow slits built into its walls. This farmstead stood fortified against Saxons, Normans, roundheads, pesky neighbors with unruly kids, probably lots of things. For centuries these hills ran wild with, well, with wild hill runners. We traveled along heights fenced 400 years ago by practitioners of the lost art of building dry stone walls, then entered the great pine woods known as the Forest Far, and took a wrong fork somewhere and got lost in an open-pit coal mine. This was neither interesting nor scenic. But we picked up the Sarn Helen again in a little town called Unklin. Now the going turned dirty. There was nothing in the scenery to warn us, but the Sarn Helen became as bad a road as I've ever been down in anything except a metaphor. We were in rolling, pleasant upland. Parts of Beverly Hills looked more ferocious, but the track across this peaceful greenery was vicious slop, broken only by chapel-width boulders and ruts where you could lose Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. The roadbed bucked and dipped like an amateur prostitute, and the bank angle tipped to the limits of a protractor's descriptive abilities. All this was spiced with greasy, knife-sharp ledges of shale, oleaginous grass clumps, Olympic-sized mud puddles, and just plain great big holes. Half an hour in, soldiers began appearing. They sloughed toward us along the road, muddy and exhausted-looking. One of the Brits among us claimed they were candidates for some special commando force. He said they're put out at the end of the Sarn Helen with one extra pair of dry underpants and a piece of zwieback or such like, and if they find their way back alive, they're in. At the end of the Sarn Helen, we forded the quick headwaters of a river and found ourselves looking down into what may be the most beautiful valley on earth. It is a wide and gentle-sided dell, done up in all the most exquisite shades of green, emerald, hunter, loden, apple, jade, and olive, with tiny farms curling up each slope as though some wonderland were cupped in vast angelic hands. But enough aesthetic palaver. If we had wanted beauty, we'd have been riding women, not cars and trucks. Ouch! Stop! Ow! Ouch! It's important when writing macho-type automotive journalism to do it where your girlfriend can't see over your shoulder. From the beautiful valley, we followed secondary roads northwest to Llandovery, getting caught in a herd of sheep along the way. The sheep were being drovered in the time-honored dog-nipped fashion, except that modern Welsh sheep have big iridescent orange patches spray-painted on their sides for identification. This would certainly spoil the looks of any Staffordshire pastoral china figurines depicting Daphnis and Chloe, his shepherdess love. The sheep looked as if they had been hanging out in the New York subway system. Llandovery, an old center for Welsh drovers, sheep cowboys, had great charm in a sober Methodist way, all the more sober since we missed pub hours. From Llandovery we went north up the River Tywi into the Cambrian Mountains. From their peaks we could see Cardigan Bay, 25 miles in the distance. The Cambrian Mountains were the hideout of Twymsi and Cotty, the Welsh Robin Hood. The difference between the Welsh Robin Hood and the English Robin Hood is that Twym stole from everybody. Also, he had a sense of humor instead of Maid Marian. According to my guidebook to South Wales, Twym once went into an ironmonger's shop and asked to buy a cooking pot. The storekeeper showed him one. "No," said Twym, "that has a hole in it." "I don't see a hole," said the storekeeper. Twym took the pot and jammed it down over the storekeeper's ears. "If there's no hole," said he, "how'd I get your head in it?" Then Twym cleaned out the store. A teeny but perfectly maintained byway led through the mountains past the Clyn Brian Reservoir to a small chapel called the Sari Minyad. We paused while David E. Davis had his picture taken in the pulpit, and I pondered why some Celts got John Wesley in dirty old coal mines, while other Celts got whiskey recipes and popes with swell hats. If you ask me, the Welsh couldn't spell well enough to find the boat to Dublin. Outside the chapel was a steep hill, its bottom third a smooth, wet, and naked rock face. The proper driving technique here was to take a fast run at it and stand on the gas and pray. We side-slipped and slithered. It was like trying to stuff a snake up a drainpipe. But we all made it to the top, I with my eyes closed. Then it was national debt size ruts and bogs as soft as a politician's conscience as we descended to Llanthui Brevi, site of the 6th century synod, where St. David refuted the Pelagian heresy. By this act, he saved all of Western Europe from a religion that sounds like a skin disease. In Tregaron that night, at the Talbot Inn, a wedding breakfast was being held in the bar. It had been going on for 10 hours. Welshmen like Mr. Davis put great stock in Welsh singing, but to my Irish ears it sounds like men jumping off chairs into a bathtub full of frogs. As soon as dinner was over, Philip Llewellyn, who was serving as our chief of reconnaissance and native ghillie on this trip, decided to prove to the wedding party that, although he is only half Welsh, that half is from the throat to the liver. Of course, the rest of us had to help. Our tab outran the weddings within an hour, and by midnight we were as drunk as any leek-wearing taffy you could find in a day's ride by sheepback. Pubs in the UK, it's true, close their doors at 11:30. But what does it matter as long as you're on the inside of them when they do? The landlord waxed fond with our spending abilities and slapped down 2 bottles of whiskey, gratis, on our table. The landlord's wife slipped in and prudently took 1 bottle back. This whiskey was, I swear to you, named Old Sheep Dip right on the label, which proves once again that Protestants will drink anything. Methodists serve grape juice at communion, you know. We finally put a stop to Philip's singing, so he began to tell stories. Llewellyn is a marvel at this. The rise and fall of empires, the passing of ages and eons, 'tis but the wink of the eye, a cloud across the sun, a breeze playing in the summer wheat. He was quoting Shelley's Ozymandias when I left him at 3 a.m. As I tucked myself into bed, the wedding party was beginning a giant brawl in the street below. I dozed off to the merry sounds of police whistles and breaking crockery. How do you tell the bride at a Welsh wedding ceremony? It's important because she's the one you're not supposed to punch in the face. In the morning, Llewellyn looked as though he'd been on the losing side, but he couldn't remember whether he'd gotten into the fight or just finished the bottle of Old Sheep Dip. We refueled in Pontford Findigid, pronounced huh? And took a gravel road back east into the huge stretch of grazing lands known as the Great Welsh Desert. Not many people live here, and I'm not so sure about those who do. Every time I got out of a car to relieve myself, the sheep would start backing toward me, looking over their shoulders expectantly. About noon, we left a rough gravel drover's road and attempted to strike out across the Great Moor on the divide of the Cambrian Mountains. Llewellyn, in the Cherokee, was in the lead at the top of the hill when, squish, Cherokee and Philip all but disappeared. Now how can the top of the hill, where we were, be wetter than the bottom of the hill whence we came? It is the miracle of the peat bog. Peat, by the way, is found only in Celtic countries because God realized that the Celts were the only people on earth who drank so much that they would try to burn mud. Our hill had once been a basin where constant flooding encouraged the growth of ferns and their ilk. Dead fern bodies accumulated in the waterlogged mass that finally even other ferns couldn't grow in. Sphagnum moss took over. This can grow in the vilest muck. Layer after layer of sphagnum was laid down until the bog began to rise above the level of the surrounding land. By all rights, this mound should have begun to drain and turn itself into a nice dry hummock or knoll or something, but instead the collected sphagnum acted as a giant sponge and swelled prodigiously with rainwater, so that after 7,000 or 8,000 years, we had a convex swamp 30 feet high at its peak. We also had a stuck Llewellyn. Crawthorne charged to the rescue with his Range Rover and went down too. Then I put the blazer in, because 3 is a lucky number. We spent an hour and a half winching one another out. The only way across such mire is to use an actual boat anchor on the end of your winch line and pull yourself across. But it would have been irresponsible and dangerous for us to have tried something like that. Plus, we might have missed lunch. So we gave up four-wheeling. We took a drive around the Elan Valley reservoirs instead and paused to view the great Edwardian edifice of the Claerhruin Dam. It looks like Hadrian's Wall never did, but should have. The reservoirs are a sore point with the Welsh, however. Their water goes to Birmingham, England, where water rates are much lower than they are in Wales. Also, the reservoirs cover a cottage where Shelley lived in 1812, and the Welsh don't hold with throwing cold water into the windows of poets' houses. And that was it for us. Sunday afternoon was waning, and we were all due back in London that night. From the Elan Valley, we continued east via normal roads. On our way to the English frontier, we stopped at Rioter for a delicious lunch. There, we were set upon by punk rockers and thrashed nearly to death. Actually, the last sentence is a lie. I just put it in there to keep readers from being jealous. I mean, we're out wallowing in fun all the time while you have to stay home and buy magazines. So I thought if I told you we all got beat up, you wouldn't get mad at us and go buy Motor Trend or anything. Besides, I'm an honorary Welshman now. And as Gerald, the 12th century Archdeacon of Brechin, said in Descriptio Cambriae, the description of Wales, a formal oath never binds them. They have no respect for their plighted word, and the truth means nothing to them. To a people so cunning and crafty, this seems no great burden, for they take it all very lightly. Boom, squeal, boom, squeal, yip, yip, yip. A day spent in a Bugatti EB110. Automobile, 1993. The Bugatti EB110 has 552 horsepower. The imagination lurches in fishtails. There, at the command of my scuffed Bass Weegians, 552 horses. What would 552 real horses do, besides make a mess on this scenic road in the Apennine foothills? And would I make a worse one? But the clutch was facile, the accelerator smooth and positive, the car entirely comforting. I headed up a short, rising straightaway toward a tight right-hand bend. This was an automobile of power, but power was sang-froid, gentlemanly power. There was a fine, light, diplomatic touch to the EB110. It was a well-bred Gran Turismo, until the tachometer reached 4,000. The quadruple turbochargers kicked in. My brain flattened against the back of my skull cavity. The blood was driven out of my knuckles, knees, and nose. All my bodily orifices shut with a snap except for my eyes, which I'll probably never be able to close again. I went around that hairpin before I could think. This didn't matter. I was in a realm beyond thought. I was transformed. A force, an inspiration flowed from the Bugatti's overboard 3.5-liter fuel-injected V12 engine through the throttle linkage up my leg and into this dull, middle-aged corpus. My waist nipped in. My jowls grew taut. The lines of my bifocals disappeared. I had the acuity of a 20-year-old. No, a 10-year-old tall enough to see over the dashboard. I had more skill, better coordination, and quicker reflexes than I'd ever possessed, than anyone had ever possessed. And the Weegians became made-to-measure, hand-sewn antelope skin-driving shoes from Lobbs. 552 horsepower. In a 3,572-pound car, almost the same power-to-weight ratio as a Messerschmitt 109, but the Bugatti is able to stay on the ground. Triple differential all-wheel drive distributes the largesse of torque. 27% goes to the front end's galactically large Michelin Pilot FX MXXX3s with their 18-inch BBS forged composite wheels set like metallurgical jewels in rubber signet rings. 73% goes to the even bigger possum mashers at the back. What ensues is not handling, but a Nietzschean dream of will. There is no sense or hint or inclination of any movement other than forward. I was going 70 miles an hour in second gear coming out of the first turn, and hell, I shifted up for the next switchback. 552 horsepower in my control, like steak on a dinner plate. A wheel that came to hand better than a custom-fitted Purdy shotgun, and a leather seat that was a hug from behind by a naked Guess Jeans model. I suppose the EB110 is very, very wrong, a terrible waste of the Earth's precious resources, and a vehicle that's been described in blatantly sexist terms besides. We're entering another of Western culture's episodic fits of Puritanism, and this is no time for the kind of loose money and big fun entailed in buying a $347,000 non-public transportation system without room for the carpool, or even a spare copy of Earth in the Balance. Maybe I can excuse the Bugatti in 1990s terms by saying it makes me feel empowered. But I suspect what the virtue twerps of Clinton world mean by empowerment is having a hissy fit at the local school board for not distributing enough preschool-sized condoms to Head Start students. Our president, the fat kid who played saxophone in the school band and told on us when we were smoking in the boys' room, him and his wife, the Iron Dingbat, don't even drive a car. They ride around in the back of long, black, tax tractors, fogging the windows with damp exhalations about reinventing government. What do the likes of the Clintons know about real empowerment? What do they can of aluminum engine blocks, five-valve cylinder heads, and twin banks of dual overhead camshafts? A fig for your politics of meaning, Pudgy and Ruffles. I have touched and held a thing so exquisite in its delivery of puissance that it can cause a professional journalist to recite John Milton in a car magazine. And joy shall overtake us as a flood, when everything that is sincerely good and perfectly divine, with truth and peace and love, shall ever shine. Then, all this earthly grossness quit, attired with stars, we shall forever sit, triumphing over death and chance and thee, O time. A time of 0 to 100 kilometers per hour in 3.46 seconds, to be exact. DEV-110 was so empowering it made me a citizen of Reagan's America again, richer, happier, never married, and, yow, great big tanker truck on little Italian back road, slightly hyper. Fortunately, the Bugatti has huge brake discs with 4 piston calibers on each, or I would have this earthly grossness quit too soon, big time. Anyway, there I sat after my first drive, attired with stars, or at least with a bunch of them floating in the front of my pupils, and triumphing over death, chance, etc. Some people have wondered whether the new Bugatti company is serious about building automobiles. No less an authority on seriousness, not to mention Puritanism, than John Milton says, and how. David E. Davis, Jr. and I were the first members of the American Automotive Press to be allowed to take the EV-110 on real roads. We flew to Bologna and settled in at the magnificent Grand Hotel Baglioni, with room ceilings as high as a Grateful Dead fan, and service faster than Andre Agassi's, and much better mannered. Here we were met by the charming Dr. Stefano Passini, who is both the public relations director of Bugatti and a prominent ophthalmologist, a good thing considering how corneas go squash when the Bugatti's turbochargers light off. Dr. Passini, a man with such an Erasmian sweep of automotive knowledge that he is able to name what Elvis drove in the King's car racing movies, entertained us lavishly. In case anyone is wondering whether our journalistic objectivity was being unduly influenced by Bugatti's hospitality, of course it was. That's Dr. Passini's job. And let me tell you, for a city named after a brown bag lunch, Bologna has some remarkable restaurants. Not that it made any difference. We could have been given an, as it were, Bologna sandwich and a test drive in an Autostrada rest stop, and we would have gone all faint and blushing over the EV-110. Properly rested and sobered up, we drove from Bologna, past the outskirts of Modena, to Campo Galliano, where Bugatti's astonishing factory is located. The buildings were designed by Giampaolo Benedini, who also designed the EV-110 itself, and who is a vice chairman of Bugatti Automobili S.P.A. The main offices are made up of a huge tinted glass cylinder, a huge tinted glass cube, and a couple of other huge tinted glass shapes that I don't know the names for because Sally Bungard had missed a button on her blouse the day they taught those in solid geometry class. Directly behind the offices is an engineering facility covered in enameled steel siding, colored deep Bugatti blue. This structure is gently rounded at the roof so that it resembles either very handsome industrial architecture or the world's largest and most frightening jello dessert. After dessert comes the factory proper, a kind of louvered affair like a Venetian blind tossed out of the Brobdingnag dump. Not that there is anything dumpy about any of this. The whole compound is designed to the furthest extent, plated, etched, turned, and milled in Platonic industrial style. The rugs, the walls, the reception desk, even the ashtrays are all at Euro-aestheticism's cutting edge. And plop down on the sofa and you'll find cutting edge to be no empty phrase. The bathroom is so alto tecnico that there are no light switches. The building senses when you're in there, and the lights come on automatically. Of course, this is Italy, and the lights come on automatically late. So you discover you're taking a leak in the sink. Or maybe not. Since the fixtures are so modern, it's hard to tell the sink from the urinal, from the soap dish, from the hand dryer. But, being fair to Giampaolo Benedini, I may not like his bathroom, but he's done a hell of a job on the automobile. The problem of supercar styling is aerodynamics. They all look like jet-propelled cheese wedges. Benedini has worked on the basic shape, moving the wheels to the ends of the bodywork, plumping out the cam back, integrating the roof line in a smooth dorsal curve, bobbing the blunt little nose, putting sensual lines in a functional medium. The result is compact, beautiful, even cute. Benedini has created personality in a supercar, without resorting to the Fokker triplane brutalism of the Countach, or gimmicks like those Testarossa side strakes that make me think of an old Briggs & Stratton lawnmower engine, or the crew-cut attachment on a barber's electric razor. The factory part of Bugatti is rather small, but it's very busy and very clean, and so well organized that it exerts a strong visceral appeal to that aspect of the male psyche which has too much coffee on a rainy Sunday and goes to the basement and sorts all the finishing nails into labeled mayonnaise jars. Only 47 Bugattis had been delivered as of the beginning of September. Total production for 1993 is targeted at 98. Three cars a week were being made when we were there. They hope to be making one car per business day soon. Even at $347,000 a pop, it's hard to see how this is going to make money for Romano Artioli, who bought the dormant Bugatti Marquis in 1988. But I gather that other companies, Michelin, Elf, BBS, Nagamichi, Aerospatiale, Belco Avia, IHI, have signed on using the EB110 and the forthcoming EB112 saloon as test beds and rolling advertisements. Bugatti's engineering staff will undertake consulting and research and development work for other corporations, and Artioli's wife, Renata, has begun a design firm that will market clothing, accessories, jewelry, and luxury goods under the Bugatti name. I hope she stops short of men's cologne, though the various scents of garages, showrooms, and racetracks have pleasing associations for me. I've yet to hear a woman say, you smell like a car. Dr. Bassini explained all this, but I was distracted by the Bugatti headquarters conference table, the most complicated piece of furniture I've ever seen, made out of a sheet of glass as thick as Donna Shalala, supported by enough alloy tubing to build a birdcage Maserati. Also, the Bugatti test track is right there on the company grounds, and I don't mean over in the corner of the lot behind a bunch of crash barriers. The track goes from the back door of the factory around behind the engineering department, takes a hard left at the management parking lot, comes within pit stop distance of the conference room window, hangs a Louis at the front side of the jello mold, and becomes a high-speed straight directly in front of the assembly line employee's entrance. Everything Dr. Bassini said to us was punctuated by baritone exhaust notes, shrieking tire treads, and a peculiar sound the Bugatti makes when its turbocharger wastegates close down, a noise David E. likened to small dogs being run over by radio flyer wagons. Boom, squeal, boom, squeal, yip, yip, yip. When was the last time anyone sat down to talk about the car business with a GM executive in earshot of an actual car? We had to get into one of these Landleers. Dr. Bassini sent us off with Giuseppe Montorsi, a test driver of great ability and courage who proved to be a passenger of even greater courage plus self-restraint. We drove up into the hills toward Mount Cimone on the road to Pisa until Montessori found us a squiggle of secondary pavement that went through a couple of villages whose signposts passed in a blur of Romance language vowels. The small road emptied into a long downhill sweep of two-lane highway, which we would turn off for a bad flycast of a hill, climb back to the small-town streets. This was testing in real-life conditions, with kids and cats and Fiat Unos and tiny old ladies in black scattering out of the way, and that great big tanker truck which didn't. The more I drove the EB110, the more hopelessly enamored I became, and I'd been a regular Tristan to his vehicular Isolde since my first tug at its neat little self-centering, race-gated six-speed gear shift. The Bugatti's transmission is housed within its engine block, below the right cylinder bank, and parallel with the crankshaft, But, unlike most cars whose gearboxes are not quite where you'd expect them to be, there's no feeling of slack or play in the 110 shifting. The stick is as positive and the throw is as short as on any old muscle car with a Hurst. And the 110's chassis is as rigid as Detroit iron, although this is achieved with Aerospecial's carbon fiber technology instead of a ton and a half of welded steel frame. There was no feeling of structural flex inside the car, and there was road feel only in the purest sense of that term. I could feel the road all right and plenty of it, but I couldn't feel anything in or on the road, none of the bumps, dips, paving cracks, potholes, and cobblestones with which rural Italy is liberally provided. And if I crushed some nuns or baby carriages, I didn't notice that either. The 110 is the only hugely powerful car I've driven that has what an Oldsmobile salesman would call ride. This is the result of a double wishbone pull rod suspension system, possibly as complex as the Bugatti conference table. David E. and photographer Martin Goddard were standing by the side of the road between the two villages as I came missling through a photo op bend. David E. said he could see the Bugatti's wheels and axles in frantic, bubbling, liquid motion against the pavement surface, while above it all, the Bugatti itself was steady as the Liner France. Personally, I'd say the Liner France has a lot more body roll. David E. did quite a bit of standing beside the road. Despite his superiority in rank, age, and merit, I shamelessly hogged the auto. I practically had to be pulled out of the car by my hair, and considering the 110 sill height and the snug dimensions of the Poltrona Frau glove leather upholstery, being pulled out by the hair is almost the only way to exit the Bugatti gracefully. Herewith, a few other small criticisms. The folks able and willing to purchase a GT for the third of $1 million are likely to be men of substance and probably not too young. I'm not too young myself, and am getting to be a man of substance, in girth if not in wallet. Fortunately, I'm a short man of substance, and the 110 fit me very well. But, for a more physically imposing fellow, David E. Davis Jr., it was a squeeze. A memo to all designers, automotive and otherwise. Will you please quit reinventing the door? There are certain things, sex, beer, radios, you can tune with the knob, that mankind got right on the first try and they don't need improving. The 110's doors open with an upward-forward throws-like-a-girl motion, and they are closed by reaching way out of your seat and making like you're going to do a one-arm chin-up, then not getting the thing to fully latch, whereupon you can't find the door handle to open it again. Also, for an automobile that has more glass canopy area than I.M. Pei's new entrance to the Louvre, there's not enough air conditioning. And the Subaru SVX-style window within a window is not big enough, especially if, like me, you're trying to jettison your cigar ash at 100 miles per hour. But these are my only complaints, and they are of a Sharon Stone has ugly toes caliber. I do not, alas, know whether Sharon Stone has ugly toes, though I certainly have seen the whole rest of her on the movie screen. Speaking of feet, here's another rarity in a very high-performance car. The 110's pedals are all in the right place and not mashed together like the tiny buttons on a Japanese car stereo, or pushed so far over to one side that you might as well let the passenger operate them. Nor does the 110 have any noticeable motor vibration, which is unusual in any mid-engined car, and amazing in one where the mill sits behind a glass partition closer to your head than Grecian Formula 16. Except for those puppy squeal waist gate noises and whatever tire skid sounds you can summon the courage to make, the car is very quiet inside. I'd even prefer a stronger exhaust note, but such things are not allowed by all-knowing and hearing governments these days. And on the subject of government, keeping an eye out for uniformed ticket-dispensing representatives of same will be a big job in a car that can go 230 miles per hour. Fortunately, the Bugatti has excellent visibility in every direction but the back, and nobody's going to be coming at you from there. I took a few more loops around our ad hoc testing ground. There is no exaggerating what the proper use of four-wheel drive does for road holding in a massively powerful car, and no describing it either. On rails hardly serves as a metaphor since that Amtrak mess near Mobile. The Bugatti 110 simply goes in the direction you tell it to go before you finish telling it, and stops going in that direction exactly when it ought to, Neither its front nor its rear has any opinions of its own or crackpot notions about where the car should be headed. I took the 110 down onto the highway and let it out. 80 in second, 100 in third, 140 in fourth. And this side of the Bonneville Salt Flats, just forget about the rest of those gears. All these speeds were as quickly achieved as a remote-controlled channel change, and without grazing the 8200 red line. I didn't deign to consider oncoming traffic. Anything that hadn't reached me yet would never do so before I was back in my lane. And thus, empowered as all get-out, I swatted past any number of puritanical trucks and democratic buses and cars lumbering at Clintonic jog pace. In a Bugatti EB110, you can triumph over death, chance, time, and even Hillary. I know John Milton got blind and sanctimonious later on, but before he did, he must have done some fast driving, possibly in a postchaise drawn by 552 horses. A borderline experience, touring the impoverished Mexican frontier in a Lincoln Town Car with a flashy blonde. Automobile, 1987. The U.S.-Mexican border region isn't one of Earth's garden spots, especially not now when low oil prices, corruption, and enormous foreign debt have created the worst, economic crisis in Mexico's history, and that's going some. But the truly devoted tourist likes to avoid the crowds, and the only crowds on the Mexican border are swimming across it. Automobile said they'd get me a car and a photographer if this was really where I wanted to go. I went to pick up the car at the Ford offices in Dallas. I was expecting a Bronco or a four-wheel drive pickup. Ford handed me the keys to a designer series Lincoln Town Car, metallic silver with silver leather interior, silver vinyl Landau top, power moonroof, and a big sign reading Cartier on the trunk lid. Driving this through the barrios of Juarez would, I thought, be like sending the Pasadena Rose Parade through Watts in the middle of an outdoor-run DMC concert. Then the photographer arrived. It was Maria Kratcherovic, the beautiful Czechoslovakian girl whose hand-colored photos make the editors in the front of this magazine look a lot better than they do. But Maria is a bit too beautiful, blonde, tall, and emphatically shaped. Between Maria and the Lincoln, I was sure I'd attract less attention in Mexico if I brought the Pope. Czechoslovakia is a serious and orderly country, and Maria had emigrated from there to Ann Arbor, Michigan, one of America's most serious and orderly towns. It was news to her that people kept goats in their kitchens, throwed soiled Pampers out car windows, and used the ditch beside the road for the family Maytag. As soon as we'd crossed the Rio Grande, Maria began calling the border the Tropic of Dirt. We crossed at Eagle Pass into the Mexican town of Piedras Negras, about 145 miles southwest of San Antonio, and somewhere near the bleak locale of Larry McMurtry's Lonesome Dove. I piloted the Lincoln through Piedras Negras's warren of tiny side streets, feeling like the captain of the QE2 on a cruise through the canals of Venice. No rocks and bottles were thrown by the populace, however. I'd figured this car would get us sentenced to life in prison for first-degree gringoism. Not so. We received nothing but approving looks and profuse compliments. The Mexicans thought the town car was muy bueno, an automóvil superior, or, as one Pemex gas station attendant put it, el car boss. This says a lot about the unenvious good nature of the Mexican people. I'm not sure what it says about the Ford styling department. To tell the truth, I was glad to get into Mexico. All the minimal clutter and highway strip development disappeared in Piedras Negras. The market was still downtown in an ancient adobe building. Music blurted from loudspeakers in the market stalls. Outside, mufflers dragged behind cars, and people were all over the place laughing and yelling. Mexico is a mess, but it's a lively mess. And, best of all, there are no Taco Bells. Mexico is the only place in North America where you can escape the horrible Mexican restaurant plague. They have great hamburguesas in Mexico, excellent perros calientes, hot dogs, delicious quesadillas, toasted cheese sandwiches, and wonderful huevos revueltos, scrambled eggs. But if you want a double dog food taco and a rock-hard corn tortilla, you have to go back to the States. But I used to be a hippie, so you shouldn't trust me about Mexico. Anything that reeks of natural minerals and native tradition is better than anything plastic, as far as I'm concerned. Of course, I might think differently if I had to choose between an artificial heart valve made of polystyrene and one made of adobe, as Maria was quick to point out. Maria was also quick to point out the stuffed frogs. Oh, God, what's that? She screamed when she got her first look at three shellacked amphibians standing upright with miniature mariachi band instruments in their webbed forelegs. Stuffed frogs, posed in various clever ways, were for sale in all the border towns. But for sale to whom? Even the most addled tourist isn't going to bring home a frog swinging a golf club as a souvenir. Souvenirs are supposed to evoke memories. Who'd want to remember a thing like that? Stuffed frogs are one of the aesthetic mysteries of Mexico. I only bought a couple of the really good ones working out with Nautilus equipment. There were a lot of other aesthetic mysteries in the Piedras Negras market. Who wants a sombrero the size of a hot tub? Or a 45-pound onyx bunny? Or a 3-foot sculpture of Don Quixote made out of welded coat hangers? Maybe nobody, because vendors were throwing themselves at us as we walked through the aisles.
Señor, a painting of Sean Penn on velvet for the lady?
Señorita, Aztec pottery, almost genuine.
The largest selection of cement burrows for your yard.
Many fine wallets embossed with the Virgin Mary. Maria said this importuning was a sign of economic desperation, but I don't know. You have to remember the national sport of Mexico is getting a large farm animal into a sports arena and teasing it. I think the Mexicans just know how to get the most fun out of the tourists. And I think New York's Fifth Avenue would be a lot more festive if the salesman at Tiffany's ran out the door and chased you down the street yelling,
"My dear man, simply observe the understated elegance of this sterling silver baby porringer available with the baby's own future country club name engraved upon it."
We headed northwest out of Piedras Negras along the Rio on Mexico Route 2. Here, my second big worry about the Lincoln disappeared. It's hard to describe Mexican pavement conditions without using swear words. I figured the town car would get its Cartier signature self-shaken to rubble in a twinkling. The Lincoln has a mushbucket suspension in the great Buick Roadmaster Packard Caribbean tradition. But this is a mushbucket that works. The wheels just slurped and gobbled all the heaves, holes, and whoop-de-doos. I've driven a lot of miles through Mexico in everything from off-road racers to Saab turbos, and this is the first time I've been comfortable. It was also 95 degrees outside with Hiroshima-class sunshine, and the town car's air conditioner was still able to give us frostbite with the moonroof open. Furthermore, I'd filled the poor vehicle with horrible Pemex gasoline, which has less octane than fruit cocktail, and the engine just purred along, not a knock, ping, or burp to be heard. The scenery, unfortunately, was not as pleasant as the ride. Scattered along the highway were little rancheros made from cement blocks, wattle, corrugated tin, and whatnot. Chickens and children all over the place, and yards festooned with old car bodies, oil drums, and bald tires. The north is to Mexico what the west is to the United States, the place people pick up and go to make a new start. Except in Mexico, they're not looking to get a bit part on Dynasty. They're hoping for 2 acres of scrubland, one cow, and a 20-year-old truck. Maria was shocked at the living conditions. She looked like Eleanor Roosevelt must have the first time somebody showed her a coal mine. I didn't have the heart to tell Maria these people were doing pretty well. Route 2 stops at the Del Rio border crossing. Beyond this are the trackless Serranias del Burro, the Donkey Highlands, which form the Mexican side of the Big Bend country. To continue west, we had to go back to the United States. The U.S. Customs agents took a long look at the dirt-smeared Lincoln. Its vast back seat was filled to the windows with camping gear, bags of canned goods, suitcases full of Banana Republic clothes, tubes of sunblock, coolers, thermoses, and 15 gallons of bottled water. You can't be overprepared south of the border.
"How long you been in Mexico?" asked an agent.
6 hours. They went through the car and everything in it and on it and under it. I wanted to ask them if this is how narcotics usually come into the country, with good-looking blondes and something that probably belongs to Liberace. If so, you'd think they'd be able to stop a lot more of the drug traffic than they do. But I restrained myself. The agents were already grumpy enough trying to figure out whether shellacked frogs are on the endangered species prohibited import list. They aren't. Customs let us go after an hour, and we drove west across the spectacular Pecos River Canyon and into the broad, grassy basins of Valverde County. The land was astonishingly empty, and you'd better come see it quick, because I'm sure some new Phoenix or Houston is slated to go up here any minute. The Lincoln was swell on its home turf. We just pointed it at the setting sun and let it go. I have a few minor complaints. The speedometer only reads to 85 miles an hour, while the 5-liter V8 will easily shove the car to 100 and maybe well beyond. Road manners were so good and wind noise so minimal that it was hard to estimate top speed. There was a tiny shimmy up around 95, but I think this was a result of what Mexico had done to the wheel alignment. The cruise control also stops at 85, and this is not fair to those of us with a lead-filled but lazy accelerator foot. On the plus side, the town car's trip computer is way too complicated. This didn't happen to be an advantage for Maria and me, but if you're traveling with a pesky teen, all the function buttons will keep him silent and enthralled for hours. We stopped at a restaurant in the total middle of nowhere, and the food was so good that I bought the chef a drink. I wanted to find out what kind of person knew this much about cooking and this little about getting to New York or Paris. He was an ex-Marine, about 28. I'll call him Dave. Midway through his third Jack Daniels, Dave began telling me how he smuggled drugs. I go down to Buquilla Canyon in the Big Bend Park and go across the Rio with a backpack. I've got a connection down there, in this little dirtball Mexican town, with the La Familia, which is like the Mexican Mafia. Then I walk out, traveling at night. Takes a couple of days. U.S. Customs doesn't mind this, I asked. They don't expect anybody to take a backpack and walk out. But it gets a little hairy sometimes. I was working with some other guys once, and I got caught in an ambush, and three of them got shot. Maria was looking at the ceiling by now, but I'm a credulous type. Customs agents ambushed you? I asked. No way. I think it was the guy who sold us the stuff. You know, so he could get it back and sell it to somebody else. He makes more money that way. Maria and I continued west to Marathon, where we found a great little hotel called The Gage. We arrived just in time to see a Texas Plains lightning storm, rated R for violence, from the Gage veranda. I don't know what all these first-rate travel amenities are doing out here. I can't imagine the lightning storms attract that many tourists. Maybe people buying drugs like to stay and have a nice meal and a snooze. In the morning, we drove south toward Big Bend National Park. I pushed the Lincoln back to top speed. The car never loses its road feel. Of course, it doesn't have a lot of road feel to begin with, but what it has, it keeps. Usually driving an American Luxo car at Exotica speeds is like the last half minute of landing an airplane with the gear up. Often with the same results. But the town car hangs in there, and could almost be said to track if you don't count the 4 inches of on-center play in the power steering. Big Bend is more desolate than awesome or rugged. It's interesting if you've been very bad and want to see what the afterlife will be like, otherwise not. We saw some signs to the Buquillas Canyon, Dave, the soi-disant drug smuggler, had mentioned. We followed them and arrived at a small parking lot by the Rio Grande. An old Mexican was sitting on a stump. For $3, he said, he'd take us across. He led us along a half-mile path through the cottonwood and canebrake to a rowboat pulled up on the bank. There were no gates or customs agents or formalities in sight. On the Mexican side of the river, we hired 2 burros and rode up to the canyon rim, where we found a nasty and impoverished-looking town. The sole cafe was nothing but a shaded patio with a cook stove in a shed beside it. On one corner of the patio sat a dark, barrel-chested man of about 50 in a shiny American wheelchair. His legs were covered with a blanket, though the temperature was almost 100 degrees. He wore a large Rolex watch and a freshly pressed shirt and a new straw hat with sharp creases. We had lunch at the cafe, or rather I did. Maria took a look in the cook shack and demurred. As we were leaving, I said, "Buenos dias," to the man in the wheelchair. "Good afternoon," he answered affably enough. But he had a smile like a lizard's, and all his teeth were gold. I don't know, said Maria on the way back down to the river. Maybe Dave wasn't lying after all. As far as I could tell, we could have brought the treasure of the Sierra Madre or the Sierra Madres themselves,